When I think about Sabbath, I think about this picture. Now, this was actually Thanksgiving. I don't know, what was I, 7 or 8 or 9 years old? And I was there with my two sisters and my father and mother. And this was, for our nuclear family, something of what passed for a feast. And Sabbath was Sunday for us. And Sunday morning, we would, of course, go to Sunday school and then to church. And then Mom would have a roast in the oven that was cooking. And when we'd, there were two locked doors we had to get into our house. And when we'd be in that back hallway, we could smell the pot roast from the hallway. And we'd open the door, and that was Sabbath. We didn't watch TV before sundown on Sabbath. I'm not exactly sure where that tradition came in, but here we are, and we're about to enjoy food together. There's a turkey on the table. We're about to pray. Actually, my father set up that he was playing with cameras and tripods at this point, so he had set up the camera on a timer, and whenever my father would set up a camera on the timer, he'd look all stiff until he'd hear the thing click, and then he'd relax. But for me, this is what Sabbath was. Now, as I grew older, here's a family gathering in Grand Rapids. My wife-to-be is sitting next to me, so I'm in seminary at this point. And during a lot of those years, and a little bit before it, in college, and I was trying to figure out, you know, if I wanted to be a Christian, what that would mean. And I read the Gospels. I noticed a lot of quarreling over Sabbath. And I found that to be rather annoying and rather irrelevant. Why would the Bible spend so much time? Why would Jesus spend so much time wrangling with other religious officials about the Sabbath? That seemed to be an awfully poor allocation of precious biblical space to be arguing about things that seemed so irrelevant to me. Now, Sabbath actually is a pretty big deal in the Bible, and the very first story of the Bible, it comes in quite strongly. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day God had finished the work he had been doing, so that on the seventh day he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Now, what that meant for me growing up as a young lad in the Christian Reformed Church in Paterson, New Jersey, was we didn't watch TV until evening on Sunday, which meant we didn't watch Battle of the Network Stars or the strongman competitions, and we didn't get the Sunday paper. And in fact, Sunday afternoon was usually about napping or reading or playing a board game or something like that. And we were resting because God rested. Now, the fact that Saturday somehow switched to Sunday, in terms of my grade school mind, that really didn't make sense. But, oh well, that's what we did. And resting was just simply assumed to be, well, resting. On Sunday afternoons, we usually took a nap. And if it was hot in Paterson, I would take a nap in front of a box fan because we didn't have air conditioning. Now, years later, John Walton tries to correct some of our ideas of rest, because over the last 100 years, they've done a lot of archaeology in the ancient Near East, and they've discovered a lot of other texts from the surrounding communities by Israel, and actually that sheds quite a bit of light on what was happening in the Old Testament. Genesis 1 and the first part of Genesis 2 is a temple text, and anyone from the ancient world would have recognized it this way. And John Walton writes this: The difference is the piece of information that everyone knew in the ancient world and to which most modern readers are totally oblivious. Deity rests in a temple, and only in a temple. This is what temples were built for. We might even say that this is what a temple is, a place for divine rest. Perhaps even more significant, in such texts, the construction of the temple is associated with cosmic creation. So in a way, Genesis 1 isn't just building the world, it's building God's temple. And the more you learn about temple, the more you begin to understand the relationships, symbolism, and associations that are going on in that text. What does divine rest entail? Most of us think rest is disengagement from the cares, worries, and tasks of life. That's how we practiced it. but what comes to mind is sleeping or taking an afternoon nap. But in the ancient world, rest is what results when a crisis has been resolved or when stability has been achieved, when things have settled down. It's the denouement of the story. The crisis is over, and now happily ever after can begin. Consequently, normal routines can be established and enjoyed. For deity, this means that the normal operations of the cosmos can be undertaken. This was more a matter of engagement without obstacles rather than disengagement without responsibilities. Well, then why on earth did we celebrate Sabbath the way we did? Well, it wasn't unbiblical, because part of what we did every Sunday in church was usually recite the law, and most of the time it came out of Exodus 20. And I learned this in the Revised Standard Version, so if I make a word slip up here, it'll be because I'm reading from memory instead of my eyes. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. By making it holy, he set it apart. But what they did was stop working. Now, as a young boy growing up in Patterson, stop working seemed, well, do I do my homework on Sunday? And actually, when I was in college, I started a spiritual discipline of not doing homework on Sunday, which was quite countercultural, even at the Christian Reformed Calvin College where I attended, because usually Sunday was for cramming and Saturday was for enjoying. So maybe I was maybe they were better Sabbatarians than I was. But I began to associate what this rest was involving was ceasing to earn your living. And part of that came from the stories that came out of the desert wanderings and manna. You see, every day they were told to go out and collect their manna, and some enterprising people decided, well, it's kind of a pain to go out and collect manna, so I'll collect twice as much as I need for myself on one day, and I'll just have something to spare the next day, and I'll take the day off. And what they discovered was that the manna was wormy the next day. And then God said, on the sixth day, go out and gather a double portion so you have something to eat the next day. And people said, now, wait a minute, I tried this once and it didn't work, little scientists that they were. And so they decided they wouldn't collect a double portion, because who wants a pot full of worms? And lo and behold, the people who had done what was told them had a perfectly good manna to eat on the Sabbath, and the others went away hungry. Well, what was going on there? Was it miraculous? Sure. But what was the point of it? And in fact, what was manna? In fact, manna means what is it? Because they didn't know what it was. And what is Sabbath? Now, until the Babylonian destruction of the temple, Sabbath was not working, as we just saw in the manna story. But after the destruction of the temple, Jews began to gather in synagogues. They no longer had a temple. And they held services for prayer, Torah reading, and teaching on the Sabbath. Now, Torah reading in many ways replaced the sacrificial system, because they were not allowed to do sacrifices apart from the temple. And since the temple was destroyed, they couldn't do sacrifices there. So this begins the long, slow change from temple worship to synagogue worship, or and observance of the Torah or the law replaces, in some ways, the sacrificial system. But now, in the midst of the first century culture war, the Jewish people mostly lived, ever since really the Babylonian exile, the Jewish people mostly lived under pagan empires. And they were constantly faced the threat of assimilation and the destruction of their culture and their religion. So religious leaders were constantly trying to preserve their culture and religion. And the way you do that, the way you do that is by preserving boundary markers. And so certain practices and certain observances were boundary markers. And for growing up Christian Reformed, for my parents and our household, not watching TV until after the evening service was a boundary marker. Not getting the Sunday paper was a boundary marker. Now, after we all went off to college, apparently my parents moved the boundary markers because then they'd get the Sunday paper and then they'd watch TV any old time during the Sabbath. But when we were young, they were still observing it. And we wouldn't go out to eat on Sunday and we wouldn't go to the supermarket on Sunday. We were good CRC Sabbatarians before the big slide that tended to happen in the 80s and 90s. And the way you maintain this in your group when you're attracted to things like the Sunday funnies, as I was as a kid, and other people in church were getting the Sunday funnies, just not us, was you use social pressure. And you use social pressure to keep everybody in line. You reward the behavior you want, and you use whatever measure you have to discourage those who don't. Now enter two stories about Sabbath observance from the Gospels. And how do we interpret them? One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and his disciples walked along. They began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, "Look, what you are doing is, look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" You get the sense in these stories that the Pharisees are constantly watching. Because they're looking to find fault, they're studying, they're trying to figure out who Jesus is, probably trying to figure out if he'll be useful for their culture war, or if he'll be a liability. Because if you're fighting a culture war, that's usually the matrix. If people fall in line, you praise them. If they step out of line, you punish them, and you destroy their reputation. Now, there were rules in the Old Testament about gleaning, and it was said that others could go through the field, and they could grab things that had fallen behind the gleaners, or they could just kind of harvest in hand. And this is what the disciples were doing. Now, harvesting was not permitted on Sunday. So here we kind of have a test case, which is a little bit gray. But Jesus' answers sort of confuse things. He answered them, "Have you ever read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for the priests to eat, and he also gave some to his companions." Now, this is a very interesting story out of the book of Samuel, and Jesus is right. This was unlawful to do, and Abiathar does it, and there's no real explanation given except need why David should be given this bread, which was only lawful for the priests to eat. But Jesus basically says, this is allowed to be done. Now, what usually jumps into our head is practicality. So therefore, if there's a practical need, it's important. It's okay to set aside the rules. And there are, in fact, many rules like that. If your cow falls into a pit, you pull it out. And it was proper to save life on the Sabbath. And we in the CRC tried not to work, but we understood that the policemen and the firemen and the doctors and the nurses and the preachers all worked on Sabbath for the good of the people. That's a rather low-resolution, shallow view of the Sabbath. And then the question is this really what Jesus is talking about here? Then he said to them, "Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." Now there's a little bit of tension there, because on one hand, the practicality rule seems to come to the front that, well, if this is good for people, then it's okay to do. Well, but then what is the point of the boundary markers? What is the point of not getting the Sunday paper? What is the point of not watching TV until sunset after church at night? We were allowed to watch The Wonderful World of Disney. The second sentence, the Son of Man, well, now we're back into this Daniel 7 figure, where Jesus is identifying with this figure in the book of Daniel who's given an eternal kingdom, and he's given great authority. But what on earth does it mean that he's given authority over Sabbath when Sabbath is rooted all the way back in Genesis 2 and in the Decalogue? Does the Son of Man have this much authority? And how can we understand the logic with which he's ruling over the Sabbath? Another time Jesus went into the synagogue and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal the man on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with a shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Jesus knows exactly what they're thinking. Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" Now, here again, we start to wonder, well, is it the practicality rule? Is it the beneficence rule? Clearly, they didn't want to say anything. They remained silent. What they're playing for is the crowd. And so that's their game. And so they're not really ready to take Jesus on in public because they know he's popular, but they're going to try and stab him in the back privately. And they don't want to be called out as fools to say, well, you can do bad on the Sabbath, but not good, that you can kill on the Sabbath, but not save life. If their enemies would attack them on the Sabbath, which in fact had been done many times in the history of Israel, well, the Israelites fought on the Sabbath, as do the Israelis. He looked around at them in anger, and he was deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. I'm getting a phone call, hang on. And if you've been following the Jesus stories, you probably know where this is going to go. He looked around at them in anger and deep distress at their stubborn hearts, and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. I mean, their culture war was nothing to sneeze at. Now, is this about legalism? The Pharisees are usually cast as works righteousness individuals. A lot of contemporary scholarship says that's probably not fair. And it's better to understand the Pharisees in the light of their culture war, to understand their project. And in fact, many of us can understand their project quite well, whether you understand them in terms of nationalism, in terms of diversity, in terms of trying to keep their people from corruption of the broader empire. All of these goals seem good. We see Jesus as saying, put people and their practicality and making them happy and meeting their needs first. Is that really what this is about? Is Sabbath basically about doing whatever makes me happy? That's kind of the way the Christian Reformed Church went with this. Is Jesus being a jerk? Jesus could have healed the guy before or after the Sabbath and avoided the controversy. Jesus, in fact, seems more than happy to have this fight with the Pharisees, and more than happy to push these test cases in front of them. And we see this again and again. Now, I think Jesus is doing this because he is trying to establish his authority, and he's trying to make some points that will not be forgotten. And it's clear that they would not be forgotten, because here we are 2,000 years later still talking about them. And me and my college-age self, as I was pondering this, I mostly didn't get or understand the point Jesus was trying to make. Neither the Pharisees nor Jesus, neither the Pharisees nor Jesus debated the change in Sabbath practice that happened in the Babylonian captivity. That's a very interesting point. Nobody stood up in the synagogue and said, back in the day it was all about not resting and I had to walk here. And So actually something was happening in that transition from basically a day off, and sometimes today people would say, well, I'm having a biblical Sabbath. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, I'm not even going to do the work to go to church. A day off between that and then going to meet with the other people for prayer and for teaching and for all of these things. They didn't debate that at all, and that's also really rather curious. Jesus' point wasn't about rules or days. It was about Sabbath, what it is, and himself. Now, Jesus' mission is, in a nutshell, is right there in the Lord's Prayer, one of the most well-known pieces of Scripture, which is why I point to it all the time. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. That is Jesus' mission. Now, why rest on the seventh day, if we begin to understand what rest meant in its original context? Now, God from his throne now enjoys the fruits of his labor, the beginning of Genesis 2, a fully functioning creation in its glory and splendor. The status of material mana reflected the disposition of the will of its owner. See, this was the curious puzzle. Why would the mana keep over the Sabbath, and why wouldn't it keep over any of the other 6 days? You see, God from his throne was the Lord of mana. Mana was sacramental. Well, what do you mean by that strange word? Well, mana conformed in this world according to the desire of its master from heaven. Mana, in a sense, was a link. It, for them, fell from heaven, which was also sacramental, and it preserved the seventh day, which was also sacramental. In other words, mana perfectly reflected the will of the Father in heaven on earth. That's what sacraments are. Now, we have a difference between a sacramental perspective and a materialist perspective. Most of us in a secular culture are deeply materialistic. Secular culture says this: stuff and matter is foundational. Consciousness and order and form are derived and dependent. In other words, the mechanisms in matter are what make the world go around. A sacramental worldview is exactly opposite. God's consciousness is foundational, and the world is ordered by his word or logos. Notice in Genesis 1, how does God create the world? We tend to look at secularist views of creation. Well, this happened, and this happened, and this caused this, and this caused that, and that caused that, and that caused that. What happens in Genesis 1? God speaks, and the matter conforms. Genesis in John 1, you introduce the idea of the logos, which is the mind, then the word, creating habitable order out of the chaos of the tohu wavohu. Jesus' mission is to bring a rebellious world into alignment with his creator. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now here in these two Sabbath stories, the on-the-way gleaning of the disciples, now remember they couldn't fast with Jesus, we talked about that last week, was reflection of the master's concern for their well-being. They couldn't fast around him. They needed to celebrate. And if all they could afford was meals on wheels, gleaning in the field, that's what they did. The shriveled hand must be mended, just like the unclean spirit in Mark chapter 1, must be cast out. The shriveled hand must be mended to be in sync with the maker's desire for what the hand should be. This should happen on Sabbath. This is what Sabbath means. Everything in Mark, in fact, up until this point, has been about this. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. The sacramental realization of God's will in the midst of his rebellious planet. But we look around and we say, well, where is his kingdom? U2 sings, is there ever going to be peace on earth? How can creation be restored or renewed when many of our attempts actually make things worse? The gleaning of the grain and the healing of the hand were only sacraments, signs and seals of the age to come. And this is why the disciples couldn't feast among Jesus. He was, in a sense, what he was maintaining around him, what he was creating around him, was this little bit of the kingdom of heaven come near. And the question is going to be, will Jesus let the rebellion pierce his distortion field, or actually his recreation field? John 12 has a story like this. Now, there were some Greeks among those who went up to worship at the festival. These were likely Jews from the diaspora who were coming down just for the festival, and they were Greek speakers, and that's why they're called Greeks. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, with a request. Sir, they said, we would like to see Jesus. We've heard about this redemption field, and we want to see the man that creates it. Philip went to tell Andrew, Andrew to Philip, in turn, and Philip to tell Andrew, Andrew and Philip then in turn told Jesus. It sounds like they're a little scared. They needed a little team to talk to him. Jesus replied, "The hour has come for the Son of Man." There he is. "To be glorified." That sounds like what? Is everything going to become new right away? "Very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life." Now we're beginning to sense some of the drama around Sabbath. Some of the withholding and yet feasting. Some of the anticipation by longing. How do we live it out? Well, here are my sisters. The one that died is the one over holding the dish. And when we were camping, we had this little pot to do the dishes in. And if you didn't clean your dish off well, that little pot of water got very dirty and it was very gross for cleaning the dishes. And here is my sister complaining that someone left way too much food on their plate and now she has to deal with the aftermath. And my other sister's looking a little guilty, but I don't intend to point the finger. Could very well have been me. Well, what is this world like? Well, this world is a lot like this. And the dishwasher is very unsabbath like. And we don't know what to do with it. And we don't like living that way. And so in our hearts there's a longing for Sabbath, and we know it. It's built into us. Well, we have to die. And in a sense, what my poor sister has to do is put her hands in the water. But one day a week, we put our hands in the water 6 days, we begin to stop imagining that we are the Sabbath bringers. In fact, it is very non-Sabbath to imagine we are the Sabbath creators. So this is a hard dynamic. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but a seventh is the Sabbath to the Lord. And the seventh, in a sense, is when we intentionally remember to receive, that "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven" isn't quite something we bring with our own hands. 6 days we labor and do all our work, but the seventh we let him feed us, and we practice trusting. We worship on the first day of the week because that is the day of the resurrection. Sabbath is supposed to be sneaking into the world, not he world. Sabbath is supposed to be sneaking into the world. We are scandalized and resist. Can our lives become sacramental? Will we begin to conform to the shape of the Father's will? And all the time, not in a sense take over and imagine, because that's when our wills exert themselves. Can we live out, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven"?